I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Good morning. It's the main course on Heritage Radio Network, and we are broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Brunch is being served. I'm your co-host, Katie Kiefer, with my partner in crime,
Patrick Martins. No plan for this show.
That is
it's official.
Not true.
But the hell, I'm the head of the network, so even however bad this show is, as long as I don't cancel this show, we can wing it one week, right?
Yeah. Boom.
Yeah, boom. Thanks, Jack. Right?
Boom.
Yeah, no kidding. So actually, we have a great show. What are you talking about? We're just a little bit wondering where Frank Reese is, but we're going to chat with a couple of our farmers from Heritage Foods USA, Mark Newman from the Newman Farm down in Arkansas.
And there's a reason why we're talking to these farms, because last week you lassoed in Temple Grandin as a guest. And
yes,
that, you know, really one of our most powerful guests. I mean, definitely top three.
She will be back again and again. We barely scratched the surface with Temple. There was so much other stuff to talk about, not just about her designs and what's happening in livestock, but what's happening in other aspects of agriculture, including, you know, the impact of corn prices, the ethanol program, the GPSA rules.
She's very direct.
Exports,
since that interview,
imports.
Craig Good is looking for a new way to, you know, have his sows, I guess, give birth to babies, a new kind of crate system. I mean, he doesn't use it. Well, it kind of uses a crate.
Yeah, because
you know?
Temple was not in favor of the crate system.
No, she wasn't, but she found him a new machine he could use in Canada. This is a farmer in Kansas that we work with. And he and she started to talk, and she actually said that she would be willing to basically write us a set of protocols that are Temple Grandin protocols for all our farmers. So I really thank you, Craig Good, if you're listening,
amazing,
for engineering that.
That is amazing.
So there could be like a Heritage seal of approval.
Yeah.
Whether we sell the product or not, hopefully mostly for products we sell, but it
sure
could maybe be a real guideline for medium-sized farms.
I think so. I think that's just glorious. And that just speaks to the generosity of Temple Grandin, who, you know, just, I don't know if you know this, but when she first started designing her livestock handling facilities, she refused to patent them. She just put them right up on the web because she recognized that other large corporations in whose interest this might not possibly be the most excellent, that they would patent her ideas and then shut them down to the public. So she just put them right up on the web right away.
Now, I do
so
want to say one thing.
Access.
To clarify one thing, she really embraces big companies because she says that they slaughter them very well.
Yes.
So I just want to make a distinction. You know, how you raise your animals is one thing. How you kill them is another. And it sounds like she's helped on that level a great deal. The
her business
part.
Has really been life primarily working with meat packers and getting the slaughtering part, the animal handling as they go into the slaughterhouse, really down to a science so that the animal experiences the least amount of stress. And of course, this makes total sense because from the bottom line perspective, if your animal is stressed, then the meat is going to be affected. I think everybody knows that at this point, that that stress in an animal causes a flood of hormones and chemicals, most notably cortisol, which causes, in the cattle industry anyway, something called dark cutters, meaning that the meat is so dark red that it can't be sold on the consumer market. It changes the flavor.
I like how when we wrote all these questions down, we were like, oh, this should give us easily 40 minutes. And so we're like, what makes a pig happy. And she's like, pigs fear three things: dark spaces, loud sounds, and slippery floors.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, that answers that question. Next. And it was like 10 minutes into the interview where we almost had to start winging it, as we are doing today.
We could have wung it even more. I mean, after the interview was over, I was disappointed that there were many questions that we didn't get to follow up with her on. And then when I spoke to her the next day to thank her for being on the show, we had another really interesting conversation about nuclear energy, but also about more aspects of the livestock industry that she is involved with and that are changing all around the world. So.
Yeah, well, and solar is a very important thing. We also have, we should say, someone in studio for anyone who's listening to us on their iPhone in the Roberta's Garden. You're probably wondering who this other kid is. It's Dan Honig, who runs our mail order campaign, and you're actually responsible for booking Hervé. So do you want to just explain real briefly why you brought Hervé to HRN today?
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, this is Dan's voice. And so I met Hervé because we were talking about kind of changing how future chefs see, you know, the meat that comes to them. It's not just a product to produce a pretty dish, but it's something that has a whole chain that they're representing. They're representing the farmer, they're representing the slaughter, they're representing the butcher and all that. And Hervé really wants to bring that to the French Culinary Institute and teach those students, you know, where everything comes from, and make them better chefs in doing that. So I really got behind that, and I heritage and
Muse. And they'll be more responsible buyers as a result of that, and they will continue to help support small and medium-sized family farms, which is one of the things that we all take pretty seriously around here. Mm-hmm. So what's Hervé's last name?
I can't pronounce it.
Okay. Well, Hervé is the director of culinary education now at the FCI. Is that right, Dan?
He's a coordinating chef.
Coordinating chef at the French Culinary Institute here in New York. And that means that he has, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of students who cycle in and out of the French Culinary Institute. And this is really a golden opportunity both to, hear what his philosophy is about what to teach students, what's most important for them to go out into the marketplace with, and then also to, give him a sense of what we're all about here at Heritage and hopefully encourage his students to listen to the network and learn more about alternative agricultural methods and farmers. So
tell us about, since we're here with the head of special projects for Heritage, what are some of the special products that you have, and what are some of the challenges you've encountered, you know, convincing a fisherman to ship fish through us, or, you know, convincing a maple syrup producer to let us invade their home and live with them for 3 days?
Sure. So the I guess our most recent success would be the maple syrup, which was headed by Andrea Tribuca Campos.
A total success. That was a fantastic and amazing project.
Yeah, we went
I'm
out.
Really glad that we went with the foil cover, though, Dan.
There was a little debate between Patrick, Katie, and me about whether to use a plastic Aunt Jemima cover or a foil cover to make a more beautiful bottle, and I think Katie and I were in the right.
We prevailed, and we were right. You have to admit, Patrick, we were right.
No, the gold foil was definitely the best. I just think anything that needed a hair dryer almost seemed more artisan-like to hair dry the wax over the bottle. It just seemed like it more labor-intensive, therefore cooler.
Well,
but the gold foil
I didn't
was
get
very
to see
shiny.
That, but I thought the gold foil was very
shiny. It was so funny when they showed us really the bottle. Cool. We're like, we want a beautiful bottle, a beautiful, beautiful bottle. And then when we saw this like simple, plain bottle, we're like,
it's got a bottle.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautiful in its simplicity. And the maple syrup was awesome. Fantastic. Although I still haven't received my bottle yet. I don't know if there is one for me. And then lastly, about that whole thing, is you guys produced in an unbelievably short amount of time a fantastic DVD of what the sugaring process is all about. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So when we went up there, we actually got to see firsthand, you know, how to make maple syrup. So Patrick and I were working in the woodshed and helping them firewall.
Was I okay for an old 40-year-old man, someone almost twice your age? Did I
they
move
were the
my
fuel
fair share?
Engineers.
Did I move my fair share? Were you ever looking at me being like, dude, I'm doing all the heavy
nope,
lift.
Patrick's in top shape. We lifted. And he went with the flow of the sticks. One thing we learned was when you're pulling wood, you can't decide it for yourself. You need to let the wood decide for you.
Because we would pass to each other. So I would take, like, you know, I would love always to take 6 to 8 branches and then pass them to Dan so that they could in turn be passed, you know, into the fire, the flame to boil the sap. So I always wanted to get him a good group. But if you try to get a good group, you're not going with the flow of the wood.
In other words, the wood may not be moving as, it may not be burning as fast as you're trying to move it?
No, it just is that as you're pulling it from one pile to another, the way it grates against each other, you know, the viscosity of it kind of, like it chips. So sometimes I'm just handing him one piece of wood, one piece of wood, one. Yeah. Then I would get a real good group, like a nice loose pile, and hand him eight pieces of wood.
Because also imagine we're standing like next to a 10-foot stack of wood. So if you pull it wrong, they all come tumbling down. Some
you
of them were pretty
don't want
big.
That to happen. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Now, I understand we have Frank Reese on the phone now, Jack. Should
Hello.
We be going?
Hey, Frank.
Hey,
how are you?
Frank Reese from Good Shepherd Turkey Ranch out in Kansas. How are you, Frank?
Just fine.
Well, Frank, we had, you know, as you know, Temple Grandin on to talk about slaughter, and she talked about things in a very technical way, you know, very big picture political way and a very technical way about, like, what makes her pigs happy and cows happy and this and that and the actual machinery used.
She had a lot of comments on the poultry industry, too.
Yeah, and a lot of comments on the poultry industry. And so just from your perspective, as, you know, I would say used to be a small farmer, now a medium-sized farmer, an official medium-sized farmer in America, talk a little bit about the state of the slaughter industry in Kansas and for poultry producers, you know, of your size.
Well, in the state of Kansas, there's not... You know, this is not a big poultry state at all. I mean, there are no large USDA processing plants at all in the state of Kansas. So for us, it's, you know, it's very small scale compared to, you know, we butcher our process 1,500, 2,000 chickens a day, where the large industry would do 30, 40,000 birds a day. Mm-hmm.
So what about, have you had trouble finding a slaughterhouse to even do that number? Or, for instance, 10,000?
Oh, yes,
10,
especially because it had to be USDA. See, that's we had to be able to process our meat at the very highest level. And so we needed the USDA inspection. You know, to be able to ship meat across state line, it must be USDA inspected.
Right.
That didn't exist here. We are the only USDA small plant here.
No, and that's you're talking about McPherson, Kansas, right? Homer
yes.
Crable's place. And that's
correct.
One of the few places that does both cows and pigs, but also poultry in the same facility.
Yes. And we have AWA, animal welfare approved for all for cattle, hogs, and poultry.
So is there a Homer Crable for every producer like you around the country? Or
no.
So what do people like in other states do, like Colorado or Ohio or, you know, what is the state of the poultry slaughter industry? And do the big companies slaughter their birds well?
Well, it varies from state to state. Every state has their own particular rules of what they allow in their state as far as selling dressed poultry or poultry products within that state. What the majority of these small farmers are doing is they process the birds themselves without inspection,
mm-hmm.
and they sell the product, you know, to their friends and neighbors.
Or at farmers sell? Markets or...
Yes.
Yeah.
And that varies from state to state. In some of the states, you can actually process the birds on your farm without any inspection. And actually sell them to restaurants.
Wow.
There are a few states that allow that. Some states, you know, that would bother me a little bit.
A little bit. Yep.
Now, I know your biggest issue with major poultry facility, you know, companies, you know, who... You know, we can say their names, Purdue, you know, massive companies like that, Cargill. I know you don't agree with the genetics they use.
That's where the greatest suffering is, yeah.
Okay, well, explain that, first of all, and then I have a follow-up question.
Okay, most people worry about the last few minutes of the animal's life, and I have no problem with that. I think we should show the greatest respect to the animal that we are going to sacrifice for our consumption. We do not process any of our chickens on live shackles and things like that. But the real suffering that animal goes through is during those weeks in which it grows, which is unique to poultry Because you have this animal that grows 300 times faster, the genetically engineered commercial chicken, it suffers from many, many ailments because of it being morbidly obese. You know, fractured legs, fractured wings, inability to take in oxygen. It suffers from all kinds of ailments during those 5 or 6 or 10 weeks that it takes to grow it. It makes no difference if it's out on pasture, if you've got it in those tractor systems, whatever. It's within the genetics. And we know that 30 to 40% of those chickens arrive at the processing plant with fractures. So the suffering to me happens during the growing period. Mm-hmm. And those last 5 minutes or 2 minutes of its life, it is before it is either stunned or shocked in water or killed in atmospheric killing, however it may be, that, you know, if I knew I had to suffer for 5 weeks or if I only had to suffer for 3 minutes, I would take the 3 minutes.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely, I mean, it's the only danger, it's funny, ironically, that comes from Temple is that now all of a sudden Cargill is like, we have the state-of-the-art killing, and everyone's like, that's awesome, but it is a whole life of an animal that they have to account for, and it's not to say that they don't, but...
Yeah, I mean, even if you're talking pigs or cattle, they may have the state-of-the-art killing, but has that animal had to stand in a feedlot with manure up to its ankles for 18 months? Before they finally shot it, you know.
That's one of the things Temple brought up was that in areas where it's sort of a mud heavy, where they have feedlots and it's a muddy state as opposed to, say, Arizona, which is where she did a lot of her studying. But they are taking great measures now, apparently, or at least some of the plants are some of these feedlots are, to grade the slope so that there's better drainage so it doesn't create this muddy atmosphere for the animals to be walking around in. And I think that's one of the, I mean, that's definitely part of the whole animal welfare, stance that some of the larger companies are taking. But I think that the poultry industry is kind of unique in the sense, to go back to what you were talking about in terms of the genetics, they're quite unique in that sense because the animals that are being raised, in the hog and cattle field are less, they're never going to grow in 8 weeks. They're never going to be big enough. You know what I mean? So even if they crossbreed them all they can, the one thing Temple said was that they have mean pigs now because they're not culling out the bad.
Yeah,
bad
that was interesting. Ones. Do you find that the animals are more aggressive, Frank?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is a huge problem in poultry. That's why they de-beak them, declaw them, do everything else to them so they don't eat each other while they're confined in buildings.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, Frank, it's it's awesome to have you on, and to talk about this. And I mean, I don't know if this can be on the record or off the record if you don't want to answer it, but what happened with the Norbest plant? Because I know a lot of poultry farmers relied on that plant to process. So where have those poultry guys gone? And is there a chance that Norbest will reopen?
No, Norbest is gone. It was bought out by a much larger company.
And what does that mean for the farmers? That they have to raise fewer birds, or they just go?
They just don't raise them at all. There's no processing plant. Either that, or if they are able to raise turkeys, they're going to have to haul them to, Minnesota or some other state.
Mm-hmm.
People forget all these people who raise all these birds. They don't own any of them.
Mm-hmm.
The traditional farmer of today that mass produces all these chickens and turkeys. They're nothing more than contract laborers.
Right.
And so they're completely dependent upon the entire factory system for their existence. And that factory system can come in and say at any time, we're no longer going to buy birds from you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're just out of business.
Mm-hmm.
Bought them out and shut the plant down, that shut the farmers down.
Wow.
So now the farmers are out trying to find some other company who will contract them to grow turkeys.
Don't look to us. We have enough trouble selling Frank's birds.
So,
but I'm sure they're all listening. But anyway, Frank, thank you so much for being on, and we'd love to have you come on a couple times a season and give us a little insight into a particular issue, because there's no one that knows more than you, you know, about heritage breeds of poultry. So thanks so much for giving us some of your Sunday.
All right, thank
you. Good talking
to
you, Frank. So long, man.
All right, bye-bye.
This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network, and we are sponsored today by S. Wallace Edwards & Son, Cure Masters from Surrey, Virginia. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with Patrick Martins. And on the phone now, we have our friend and colleague, Mark Newman.
Hey, Mark.
How are you, Patrick?
Good, thanks. Thanks so much for giving us part of your Sunday. Where are you coming from? The fields? Are you feeding the pigs? What were you working on?
Oh, actually, I made a mad dash to the house. So
nice.
It has turned springtime in the Ozarks of Missouri.
And what does that mean?
We're going to have nice weather for quite some time.
Oh, that's good.
Winters, are the pigs happy?
Oh, absolutely.
Is it muddy?
It makes us happy because we know that our winter is behind us now.
Oh, wow. And now, is it very muddy?
No.
Okay, cool. Well, you know, the reason, Mark, we've had you on is to maybe speak a little bit about the pig industry when it comes to slaughter. And we just had Temple Grandin on last week, and it was such an honor to have her on. And, you know, she was telling us a lot about, you know, humane slaughter and such. So, you know, we wanted to pose the question to you, what is the state of slaughtering in America, you know, with regards to pigs?
Well, I think over the last several years we've come a long ways with what we call pre-slaughter stress. I mean, today within the industry, you know, no matter what I do here on my farm or many other producers do in on their particular farms, if that animal is not transported to the packing plant correctly and also handled without pre-slaughter stress at the packing plant, everything I do here on the farm is meaningless, because if that pig is stressed prior to slaughter, it makes an inferior quality product that you and my consumer is looking for.
So do you grade pigs in the same way that they grade beef? In the sense that, you know, you can see, like, there's somebody on hand who will see not just how marbled it is or how thick the back fat is, but also, like, the color and the things that determine grading in cattle?
No, in the pork industry, there are no pork quality grades as far as, like, what the beef industry has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, in our own particular situation and with a few of the elite niche marketing producers out here, we do kind of use what is called the Japanese color code chart. Which we want a product that this chart is actually, I think, numbered from 1 to 7 as far as from going from a very pale product to a darker product. you know, pork's kind of been misrepresented over the last 25 or 30 years, being called pork the other white meat.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Pork was never the other white meat. Pork was the other red meat.
So, Mark, I just wanted to ask you, I mean, in terms of even having access to this red meat, you know, with regard to slaughterhouses, where do people go? Like you, I know Slaughter of Paradise Locker Meats, you have another facility that you work with locally, but where do people like you who are independent slaughter, you know, in Iowa and in Missouri, Nebraska?
And also, what impact does that have on your prices?
Well,
like how far you have to move it?
I mean, one thing that we're seeing within the industry today, and I mean, there are a growing number of niche marketers out there, and they're all looking for very high quality processing facilities. The problem that we're having in my part of the world, in the lower Midwest, is that we are losing these facilities. Most of them are mom and pop operations that are needing to upgrade the quality of their machinery, the quality of their cryovacing equipment, and basically they just can't afford a $35,000 pig scalder or a $35,000 cryovac machine to do this. So, I mean, in our situation, I think that we're in for a time where it's going to be hard to find good quality processing. I mean, in our situation in working with Patrick and Heritage Foods, I mean, we are transporting pigs 350 miles to slaughter, and we do it with plenty of space on the trailer. That way we don't stress the animal, and they also have at least a six-hour rest prior to slaughter once they arrive there.
And you also underestimate your own driving. Mark is a very conscientious driver, and he goes straight. In the deep summer, he has a place where he hoses off the pigs to cool them down, but he doesn't make that trip any longer than it has to be.
Right.
Well, I mean, the idea of it is to shorten the time of transportation. And I mean, whenever you talk about going 300 plus miles, I mean, it does get to be of a concern. You know, in our situation, in looking at processing plants, I mean, it is a tough issue, and people today are scrambling. I mean, there are a number of small independent packing plants across the Midwest, such as Paradise Locker Meats and a few others. But I mean, I know people in North Carolina that are hauling pigs 600 miles to find a good quality processing facility.
Now, let me ask, if they were to go to a big processing facility, what's the minimum amount of pigs they would need to bring?
Oh, today I'm very sure that it would be very difficult to get one of the larger processors to do a custom slaughter on a smaller basis.
And now, I mean, would they, are there a contract? Do most pig farmers own their pigs?
No. Or,
like in poultry, it is the company that does?
I mean, the pork industry has basically chased the poultry industry. I'm not going to tell you that it's down to the big 12 and 12 companies that own pigs in America, but, you know, it's definitely 50 people that are controlling a very large percentage of the pigs that are being slaughtered. I think I saw some figures here recently that was talking about 87% of all the pigs in America are under contract, either producers growing them for another producer or under contract going to the larger packing plants.
Mark, do you see any, we should probably wrap this up, but just one last question. Do you see any movement on the part of your local government or federal government in terms of the Department of Agriculture in trying to improve the situation for small and medium-sized farmers in terms of their slaughtering options? Or do you see that the larger companies are really going to have more and more control over that aspect of the business?
Well, I think that we're going to see at least the same amount of control, and possibly even more. I mean, I think everybody in industry has their heart out toward the smaller niche producer.
Yeah.
The only thing is, in my lifetime, I mean, I'm in an area that 35 years ago had 700 pork producers within a two-county area in southern Missouri. And the extension was heavily involved through the University of Missouri and many other groups talking about ways to help the small pig farmer. Well, 35 years later, I'm the last one of 700 in this two-county area.
Wow.
Long live the Newmans.
I think it's an issue that everybody is interested. I think sometimes people don't look in the right direction. I mean, Patrick's been instrumental in building a unique thing that is being copied by many others across the country as far as putting a group of producers together, having certain sets of production protocols and the quality of the product that's going out there. But today, I mean, many people still do not realize from the producer standpoint that it is all about the satisfaction of that consumer whenever they put the fork into their mouth. That has got to be the conscientious part of the producer. We have to be concerned about that consumer. Because in niche marketing and in what Heritage Foods USA does and what I do on the side here in the lower Midwest, it's about that customer.
Yeah.
And we are after, like to say that, you know, we would like to see pigs move back outside and be done 100% on pasture and everything, but it's not going to happen like it was 50 years ago.
Well, Mark, we do have to wrap up, but I have one last question. Do you have any razorbacks broken into your pens and created any weird babies? Because we have a few customers that want to try that again.
No, we do have, in the lower Midwest, I mean, we have a growing feral pig problem. And we have not had any on this farm in about 3 years, but they are around us. They cause a tremendous amount of destructive damage within the national forest that we are surrounded by. And there is Missouri has a program that you can shoot and take these animals any time during the year.
So bring us a couple. We want officially put an order in for one every couple weeks. No, but it is an interesting taste. Well, Mark, we'll have you on a lot again this season and always. So thanks for giving us part of your Sunday to kind of give us perspective on Temple's work.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. We'll see you again. Bye-bye. Goodbye.
Following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune into The Speakeasy every Wednesday at 3 p.m., where host Damon Volte will discuss cocktails, spirits, wine, beer, tea, coffee, and all things in the liquid universe, with guests ranging from bartenders and brewers, alchemists and ambassadors, roasters and regulars, and every expert and enthusiast in between. Learn from some of the world's leading experts in mixology, bar history, distillation, and brewing about how we enjoy imbibing today. Again, that's every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my co-host and partner in crime, Patrick Martins, and we're pleased to welcome in the studio right now the coordinating chef for the French Culinary Institute, Hervé Malhiver.
Bienvenue, Hervé.
Incredibly apropos, given the Malhiver we've just had. That would be bad winter. Where does that name come from?
Malivert.
I don't know. My parents' name. I don't know where they get that from.
Where your family name come from. Yeah, absolutely.
You're from the south, though.
I'm from the southeast.
So maybe that's why. Malivert, au nord.
Well, actually, I'm from the Alps, I'm the southeast.
Oh,
so,
okay.
You know,
Chamonix and
exactly.
all that.
Exactly. So the winter, it's actually up better over there. So I don't know. I love the winter, actually.
He likes Malivert.
Yeah, I like Malivert.
Le pauvre bonhomme.
We're gonna get into, now that we've gotten past the name, we're going to get into definitely your work, but I have to ask about this. But I mean, you've cooked with Paul Bocuse, Roger Verger. We're going to talk all about this. But you were on the Olympic team for judo?
Yes, I was.
Wow, that is hardcore. So tell us, what's it like to be an Olympian?
Well, I think the best part actually is the... It's like a party. It's like, you know when I mean a party, it's just like get together and meeting the other athletes, and everybody's very humble. I don't think so is any superstar going there. Well, that was, you know, 1988.
1988.
Yes, I don't know about now.
And it's a Summer Olympics,
that
right?
That was Seoul. That was in Seoul.
So Carl Lewis, was that his?
I'll be honest with you, I pretty much see nothing about the Olympics. So okay. I have no idea who run at that time.
Because you were busy practicing judo.
Oh, exactly. And the judo, was actually the first week we did the judo. The two first week we did the judo, and after that it was we was done. And money-wise, we wasn't able to stay for the whole Olympics. Mm-hmm. So we did our week, and pretty much was back to France at that time. So
now, what were the great judo teams of that era?
France was definitely, I think it's still, France is one of the team got the most medal, but you have Korea, it's very, very strong at that time, Korea, Japan, Germany, kind of the East, Germany, Bulgaria, Romania, they have some very good judo at that time, and I think it's still kind of still definitely at the same level. Few Italian, but
and did the French promote the Olympics? Do they support investment in athletes for the Olympics, like you hear in the Eastern Europe, that they concentrate on people to pay for them to study? And
well, the thing is, at that time, you know, judo was, you know, you don't make any money. I'm like, I did the Olympic, a week later I was back to work. You know, it's,
and even, don't like cuisine?
Yeah. So even, I think, even if you, you know, I think at that time in judo, you have to be very on the top. I mean, winning the Olympics, winning all the Europe champion awards for maybe a few years, maybe to have after that some, you know, be a trainer or have your own club or something like that. But It's just tough. It's you know, I think it's better now, but it was.
So how did you? I mean, did you train classically in France? Did you go through the apprentice system? And
well, you did. I was my club was a good club. You know, it was in Grenoble. In the
Moi j'étudie à Grenoble.
Oh yeah,
I went to the university there. It's one of the few cities with the university campus.
Yes.
System.
Yeah. So we had the judo team was a very good judo team over there, and so you start from the bottom and you won your regional, and then after that you qualify for the national, you win the national, and after that you pretty much, if you're good, you can be qualified to be part of the federation. Doesn't mean you're making any money, but the kind of like the sponsor is, they will pay you the plane ticket and the hotel. That nice. Much, that's it.
And it's a federation. I love that. So they have a federation of judo then.
Yeah.
And
all the sport.
All the sport.
All the sport, you know, like the soccer one, have the, you know, you have the federation, the rugby. So, of course, to depend, you know, people play soccer. Yes, they're making big bucks. We didn't do it at our time. So definitely it's but I, we know at the end, I definitely didn't do this for, you know, it was something I loved, you know, it was fun. You know, I always love to do sport. I'm still doing a lot of sport, and I think it's good for your health. It's good for you. And
did you study judo to protect yourself in the famously aggressive French kitchens?
Well, no, the thing is, like, my father told me when I was young, is like, you're not going to be tall and big, so you need to learn how to defend yourself. Mm-hmm. So
you're kidding. He really said that?
Oh, yeah. You know,
did he do judo also?
No, no way, but, you know.
He was a boxer?
No, my dad is like, what do you want to do, watch TV all day? I'm like, you know, my father, we all on a ski also. My father was a ski instructor. So any sport was, you know, a few miles around us, we just started. And I started this with the school when I was 6 years old. It was this, every Wednesday we go to judo. And I'm like, you know, they told me I was good about it and I like it. So I'm like, hey.
So how did you transit? If you were going to the University of Grenoble, And you were...
No, I just did the judo.
You just did judo there. Yeah. So what I was asking before about classical training was in the kitchen. Did you start as an apprentice in the kitchen, or did you go through high school and then decide to get into the culinary field? Or it's kind of an odd mix, of an odd marriage there.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I did. I did the high school, and when I was 10 years old, I know what I want to do, even before that.
You knew you wanted to cook?
You knew you wanted to cook?
Well, I want to travel, and I want to cook, and I said, you know, both go well together. You know, wherever you go, it'd be restaurant, it'd be easy to find a job. So, so since I'm kids, I want to do that. So I start high school, I was 11 or 12, and I told my dad, he's like, I don't want to keep doing high school, I want to go to a cooking school now.
Yeah.
So my dad, what he did, because my dad is a cheesemaker, so he know a lot of restaurants, he sent me to a restaurant, a very good restaurant. It was a one-star Michelin at that time. The restaurant is not there anymore.
Which one was that?
The restaurant, it was a very small restaurant by the little town. My father lived in a town with 240 people. And pretty much the restaurant was everything there. It was a restaurant, was a bar, was a grocery. Pretty much, you know, you buy everything you want was there. You know, you can even buy your cigarettes. The whole thing was there. And I was 12, and he sent me the whole summer, and he told the chef, I'm like, I want him to do the same hours than everybody else. I want to treat him the same way than everybody else. And my father is like, you know, we see what's going to happen. And I kind of love it. You know, it was, you know, and
why didn't you want to be a fromageur? Why didn't you want to make cheese?
What kind of cheese did he make?
All the cheese from the Savoie, so the Gruyère, the Gruyère, the Saint-Marcellin, or some goat cheese, some little dry goat cheese.
And those are all DOC, Dénomination d'Origine Protégée?
No, everyone, because what it used to work, you know, it's pretty much, it was a cooperative. So, I mean, the company was owned by the farmer. And it was all the farmer all around. They used to buy the milk from them, make the cheese. And they used to share, so, you know, they need... Exactly.
Did they get paid a fair price, and do they still?
Well, the cooperative, the problem in France, you know, a lot of problem. All these small little cooperatives got by bigger ones because it was hard to survive for them, you know. It was very, very hard, you know, and...
Even in France,
you know, you have this, you know, this big cooperative, or they used to buy the mix, you know, much cheaper, and... And it was very, very hard. So the place stopped by much in the early 90s. In the early 90s, that's what it was done. It's still a few. It's still some good one. And the farmer, a lot of farmer in France, like where my parents live, stopped doing milk. Stopped the cow, stopped the milk, because, you know, that was not enough money to make. You know,
right.
It's a 24 hours, 365 a year job. And at the end, you know, you get a few pennies for your milk. So they move more by doing like corn, cereal, different stuff like that, you know.
So you decided, and then from this local place that your dad gave you, I mean, how did you make your way eventually?
Yeah, how did
to
you
Bocuse
get to work with Roger Verger and Paul Bocuse?
Well, I work, the region where I'm from is the region of Briac-Savarin. I don't know if you know Briac-Savarin.
Bien sûr!
Bien sûr!
And... it was a few restaurants, like the Pavillon Bellevue was a two-star Michelin, and I worked with him. So every weekend I used to work with him, and he was one of the MOF, and by him he sent me doing stage. So I do stage too with Bocuse, I did stage with a lot of the three-star, the good restaurant like that.
What would you be, grand manger? I mean, how do you apply for a job? I mean, I would think it's who you know.
Well, in France, it's this. In France, that's why even when I came here, they asked me if I have a resume. I don't know what a resume was. Okay, we don't have resume. It's pretty much you're in a kitchen, you work for maybe a year, and then you go see the chef. For most of the time, the chef is the owner, and you say, I want to move on, I want to go to the south. And then they call. It's like, oh, that's how I get Roger Verger. So he said, are you interested? You know, he needs someone for the season, for the whole summer. and I spent pretty much the whole summer, and actually I stayed pretty much 18 months over there, and it was fantastic. It was in he repaired. Working now at the school and meeting André Sautner, I feel like these are same kind of guys.
Yeah.
The passion and not easy, you know. If you do something bad, you trust me, you remember that, you know. You're going to feel it beyond your ear, you know. It's like in France.
So wait, now let's back up for a minute.
Dude, that's why I said you needed judo.
Yeah.
Yeah, to defend yourself. But so how did you end up coming to the French Culinary Institute?
I was in New York. I arrived in New York in winter 94, arriving. It was October 17, 1994. And that's pretty much when I arrived here. And
did you come in the traditional way by boat to the Statue of Liberty? And
no,
all
actually,
that?
I flew to Miami. you know, that's now I flew to Miami, and I used to work with this girl, and she's like, oh, I'm going to do a season in Miami. I'm like, all right, let's go. So come to Miami. I didn't find anything at that time interesting regarding restaurant in Miami, and pretty much, you know, find these guys and you say, oh, I need someone in New York, you know, and that's that. What I love when I came here, I pretty much start again from the beginning, because
really?
I walk here, I walk here. They like, you know, it's like.
But okay. I mean, didn't
I never
they
heard of it.
And I didn't speak any English either.
Oh, you didn't speak any English?
So I pretty much, you know, I told him, like, give me a pen, give me a knife, and let me show you what I can do. That's my resume. That's pretty much what I told the chef. You know, the chef was French. Actually.
So who was the first restaurant you got hooked up with
the
here?
The first restaurant was Boom. Boom, he was in
Boom on Spring
Street.
Soho.
Yes.
Oh, my God. There were some crazy parties that would go on back there.
Oh, yeah. That was something.
Well, let's take a short break here, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about the restaurant scene in New York and how you got to where you're going.
Traditional French
That's right. This is the main course, and we are speaking with Hervé Malivert from the French Culinary Institute as the coordinating chef there. What does that mean exactly, the coordinating chef? Qu'est-ce que c'est que ça?
Pretty much my role is over there. It's the consistency between chefs, just to make sure at l'école, at the restaurant, during the class, they're following the standard of the school.
Ah, so everybody teaches the same thing.
And what is the standard of the school? I mean, obviously, it was started by Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and it has this triumvirate of three famous chefs, Jacques Papin,
yes,
André Sortner,
and Alain
Sayac.
And Jacques Torres is one of the pastry.
Yeah, and Cesare Casella is running the Italian
5 years,
aspect
of
the...
5 years, he came when we started the Italian program.
So what is the standard? How do you unify one standard?
Our standard, what we want to keep the tradition of the French cooking, and that's pretty much what we do. In the beginning, we very teach the student. Look, it's because some of the recipe you will not see them maybe in a restaurant, but that's a technique, that's a classic. You need to know them, and because you have a lot after that, you get a lot of variety moving on. So
what is it? I mean, even break that down. So you have to know how to make a souffle, how to
exactly
reduce something. What are the tenets of French cuisine? Like, give us some of the techniques.
Well, what we call the foundation. Pretty much your foundation in cooking. If you look at cooking, you pretty much have two very foundation, who is the French foundation and the Japanese foundation. It's pretty much very the two basic.
Really?
And then you
thank God there
are
no Italians here.
Well, we have the Italian program. Our Italian program, they're following the traditional Italian food. You know, they have the way to make their sauce, their pasta. But at the end, the way they make the stock is the same way we will make. It's the same. They use the same way. Most of the way you're making a sauce, because you are an American restaurant, you are a French restaurant, Italian, is the same way.
So tell us, Japanese, French, what are those two?
Well, pretty much on a French classic, we have all the different cuts, you know, your tournage. That's what they learn first, how to turn vegetable, the different taillage you have with vegetable, making a stock, making all the basic sauce regarding a sauce espagnole with a brown sauce, making a sauce tomate, etc. So making very all the basic of the sauce. A different salad could be like a mixed salad, a composé, a classic salad. So the very learned beginning, then you learn about butchering fish, butchering meat, the way to fillet fish, the way to butchering meat, so you can go from a fillet to a leg of lamb, from a leg of lamb to a shoulder of veal.
Now, are the lower cuts very popular in France? The bellies, the trotters?
Well, yes, definitely. We do, you know, all the lot of stew we're doing using all the shoulder. We're not as much like here with the ribs. It's not very something we do as in France, but definitely our bacon, the belly definitely use, and all the tripe, you know, all the tripe to make. If you make an andouille, you're using all the intestine, making all these different charcuterie, we're using a lot for this. Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Now, contrast that with the Japanese system.
But the Japanese, the difference is on a Japanese, like, first of all, the way they're butchering the fish is completely different than we do here. The way you will do most of the time, they have their fish, they have their fish live, and the way they do, they bleed their fish to pretty much have all the blood out, and it definitely give you a beautiful color, like a white fish would be nice, clear and white. So they definitely have different way to butchering. I used to have some. We have a chef. She's a Japanese, and she do some class of sushi with us. And I show her the tradition of butchering a chicken. And she showed me that because us, we do that way. We don't use this, or we're going to use this for something else. Mm-hmm. So it's just different technique to do it. And I believe if you do like when we do our Italian program, the way they butcher their chicken is pretty much just some way they do. Mm-hmm. When I mean this tradition came back in from the, you know, the 1700s, 1800s. So of course, since the Italian or all the other country, they move their way and they have their home. But yeah. I would say this first kind of little book, or was the people use as a guide, was pretty much this French, you know, these first books. Yeah.
Very interesting. And so is that your job truly, to be a rover? Because the French Culinary Institute, how many employees are there at the French Culinary?
Well, on chef, it's around 60, pretty much over 60.
It's
60
a tremendous number
chef.
If you yes, think about
plus
it.
Plus our pastry, we close to like 100 chefs. Exactly. Plus you have the restaurant only call. And I have a big role over there also about, you know, the menu, changing the menu. So chefs sometimes came with recipes. I put recipe there. And my goal is just like to make this recipe, to scale them for the, you know, for their books, maybe four or five portion, make them do a plating, taking a picture. And then like the chef, when we put these menus on a curriculum, on a l'école, they have the picture, they have the recipe, and everybody's working on the same pace.
So they know exactly what...
Exactly.
And that way you can achieve consistency of product.
Exactly. They feel comfortable. They have the recipe. They know it works because we test the recipe.
Right. And they know what it's supposed to look like when it goes out on the plate.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now,
absolutely.
Are there any culinary trends that have happened in the world that have forced FCI to adapt and change curriculum, update it?
Absolutely. I would say when you go arrive at l'école, the restaurant l'école, you know, at the end, even if the school is a French, you know, it's a French, but we're still New York. So we twist that a little bit. So definitely we have the little bit of trend, you know, using some Asian flavor. We have a lot of recipe with an Asian flavor. We're using different, so we kind of like move on at that time from the classic French. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to see like maybe, see, sometimes we have a special, maybe a coq au vin once a while, but we definitely try to very stay on the, you know, the New York style. And of course, we always, anything new, anything moving on, anything like a new equipment, we will get it. We will teach our students. That's what I teach also. Mm-hmm. I teach all the bit of the using the low temperature, the sous vide, using all the combi oven, all this equipment.
Now, I know Nils Noren,
yes,
and
Dave Arnold,
who does a great show on Mondays here, mm-hmm, on the network, are also very into the high
tech. Absolutely.
Is that she thinks just boys like that, guys love
boys
high
are
tech.
Into the gadgets.
Well, of course we love our gadget, but at the end
thank you, Hervé.
At the end, it's, and that's why when I taught you, you know, teach them, because I work with Dave, I do some of the sous vide, but I do the one for the student. And Dev, you know, Dev is kind of a little busy now to do as much, but, you know, when he can, he's with me. But pretty much what I told your student, it's just a new piece of equipment. I remember when I started to work in restaurant, convection oven was a new thing, and nobody's like, well, what it is, I don't need that. Now, I don't think so any restaurant will work without a convection oven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's just true, a new equipment, a new way to cook, and... I believe our students need to know that now, if they say, I don't want to use that, well, it's up to them.
Right.
But they need to know.
Sure, because if they're going to go on to work in the restaurant industry, they
exactly
have to. They can't walk into a kitchen and say, oh, duh, I don't know how to do that.
Yes, you know, exactly.
Yeah,
so do you
really
get free food when your students go on to open restaurants? Do they remember you?
Well, we try to.
Yeah,
but, you
know, keep
in touch. And wait, because we have to wrap this up. But what I really want to know is, have you whacked anybody on the back of the head the way you were when you were in...
At the FCI?
Yeah.
We can't. You know, it's like, and at the end, it's the way I learn. And you know what?
It
doesn't hurt.
It didn't good, hurt you.
No.
That's right.
You know, I'm like, there's nothing wrong to get, you know, a little hand, you know, be on your head if you do something wrong.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm like, and...
You've inspired me. I think we're going to change the policy at Heritage Foods.
At Heritage,
Foods.
Yeah. I can see Patrick's going to start administering the wax right and left. Hervé, unfortunately, we have to say goodbye to you, but thank you so much.
And we hope you come
in
back and give us updates on new
curriculums. And people should check out the restaurant L'École.
Absolutely.
Which
absolutely
is located at Broadway and
Broadway
Prince.
And Grand.
No, sorry, Grand.
462 Broadway. And Broadway. Grand.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you very
thanks
much.
So much. Appreciate it. Yeah. Puts on his only blue suit. He hasn't quite mastered tying his tie on the way his sweet Sarah used to. It's been years since he's talked to the good Lord. He's not sure he even knows how, but he won't be front yard today. He goes to church on Sundays now.
No, he don't know the words to the old rugged cross, but he sings them the best that he can. 'Cause he knows that his angel is up there in heaven, and he sure wants to see her again. For 31 years they were married. She never could get him to go. Now he's up bright and early, there by 9:30, and sits on the very front row. And he bows his head with the members, and he shouts amen good and loud. If only
Laura Wirtz.
We are back with Greg
Fanslaw and
Laura Wirtz. Welcome. Well, this is, I don't know if it's bad karma to have 86 as a theme, because maybe we're going to get canceled.
Well, yeah, I always think of 86 when you 86 edition a restaurant. It's like, that's it. Well, end of story. But you guys run an organization that creates, it's basically a job billboard for restaurant workers, mm-hmm. right?
That's right.
It's the best of the best. I know, though. It looked awesome.
Because Greg's very well connected. I mean,
I might actually be able to get a job if I.
If this doesn't work out? Yeah.
If the main course doesn't get a listener. So tell us about that. We met during at Prime Meats, right?
Yep.
And you have gone, you know, to the top echelon of management within that very dynamic, very interesting restaurant group.
Yeah.
And yet you still keep a kind of. Social fabric thing going on within the industry, which is 86list.com. Yep. Mm-hmm. So how did you conceive it, and tell our listeners a little bit about its mission?
Well, it's conceived out of a need, basically. Frustration of being in the industry for years and really just looking for or creating something that will help people connect in the industry. It's, you know, being a manager, being a restaurant manager, being in the business for years, having the daily challenges. One of them is staffing and hiring and finding good people.
So now people think, oh, restaurants are like these pirate ships, you know, in the kitchen, and, you know, each one is its own locale and independent universe. But how do they communicate in and of themselves? Like, are neighborhood restaurants friendly with each other? Or if a chef goes, like, what is the state of communication between restaurants in a city like New York?
Well, the restaurant industry, and especially in New York, it's a small world. So you're constantly in touch with people that you may have worked with. A lot of jobs are found through word of mouth. But we're sort of trying to create something that's an online kind of word of mouth.
This doesn't exist already. In other words, when you want to look for restaurant work now, like, say, for instance, we just had this guy from the FCI on, right? Mm-hmm. So would we direct him to tell his students about your site so that they could potentially hook up with employment there?
Yeah absolutely. Right. This is
directed for people who are looking for jobs or for people who are looking to staff?
Both.
It's both. We basically took the job board and have married it with social networking.
Right.
We put a social networking site to the job board. It's not, most job boards are one dimensional. It's the job posting and a job responded to. So we've created it so that we have members, they can sign up, put a profile up, put their experience level, they can put their resume. So they're not just responding to an email. It actually creates sort of like a two-way street.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the same for restaurants. They can put up a profile. So there's information about that restaurant on the website at all times, whether or not they're looking for somebody. So if they are not, then somebody can find out information about their company. It can be linked to their website. And then somebody can research them as a company and then say, oh, I'd really like to work for that company. And then at the same time, they can also post jobs. Mm-hmm. So that restaurant can post a job and connect it to its profile. So when they post a job, they're not, you know, kind of reiterating everything every time they post a new job. They can just say, hey, I'm looking for a bartender, you know, nights and brunch. And if you want to check out more about my information, here it is. It's already there, so they're not constantly refilling that information out. Mm-hmm.
And how do you remind your clients to log back on? Obviously, if you're looking for mm-hmm. a job, you know that they're going to do that on their own. But let's say it's just a restaurant that's like, you know, I'm a member. Do you send out weekly emails or...
We try to keep a monthly newsletter going where we just let them know what's going on with the website and, you know, some tips on how to use it because it's really new for everyone. We've only been up since October. Mm-hmm. So we let the hiring managers know what's new. We also let them know what jobs that we're posting and giving information to the members also. So we tell them, hey, you know, these are the jobs that we have available. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you want to be a part of that, you should let us know.
Wow.
And the same for the members. You know, we send them emails. When we get a lot of new jobs up, we send an email telling them, this is what's available right now. So we keep them coming back.
And, of course, that begs the question, filters, you know, like mm-hmm. how do you make sure that, you know, or let's say you hear someone's a total jerk and you see his name come up. Are you just like,
we
no.
ax him.
Ax him?
They're done. No, we have it set up for... You know, people. We keep an eye out on spam and make sure that yeah. people are, you know, not abusing the site.
Very interesting. And what does it cost a restaurant, and what does it cost an individual?
Individuals are free.
Okay.
You can sign up, post a profile. It's completely free for restaurants. I'm sorry, for members. It's also free to sign up for restaurants. If you want to post a job, that's where we charge.
That's where you make the millions.
Wow.
That's where we charge. But for the time being, since we're new, we're offering free postings.
Mm-hmm. And have restaurants been, you know, lining up to sign up for this service? Because it seems to me it's a great idea. I mean, I love the idea of it. I
Especially
think it's
if you're opening a restaurant really, for the
really
first
efficient time.
Really efficient
way of staffing it's, your restaurant.
It's just you have a specific crowd that you're
yeah.
approaching. You're not just sending out an ad to the masses. You're reaching out to a specific demographic of people that
yeah people who have experience yeah. in the hospitality industry. I
is
think
there a way
awesome.
For them to communicate within themselves? So
yes.
for instance, if someone is like, one of them gets a catering gig and is like, hey, I need four more people.
Yep there's inter-site messaging. You can send a member can send a member a message, a restaurant can send a member can send a restaurant a message. It's all about networking.
So it's right. a little bit like LinkedIn, but for the restaurant mm-hmm. industry.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
LinkedIn, right. though, doesn't have a great reputation. I was watching 30 Rock with Ann, and they were like, I'm on LinkedIn. Kill me or something like that. Like, or I might as well be dead. Or
I'm
I forget
on LinkedIn.
What it, I was just
I've
like.
I've been recruited for a couple of jobs on LinkedIn.
People
do. Yeah, I didn't get it.
86
them,
list, baby. Come on. Get with it. LinkedIn is for losers.
Well, I guess, but I don't know. People still keep asking me to join their network. I don't know what to do with it once I am, but you know. But yours sounds like eminently practical. I mean, I love the practicality and efficiency of
that. Now, how did you get people to sign up? I mean, did you get a few core accounts and then be mm-hmm. able to be like, hey, look, these restaurants use us?
Right. That, yeah. I mean, that's definitely our plan, was to start with some of the larger companies that have more than one restaurant and
yeah.
and show their recruiters what...
What
we
can do.
What, yeah.
Right. So like
and
Union Square
the
Hospitality Group or something.
Did you guys figure it out yourselves?
No.
We found a great web firm in South Dakota.
Oh, nice.
That had a great look and a great aesthetic, and we contacted them and they were awesome. And
it's always the one state we have no listeners. Maybe this segment will help change that.
I think we'll have to call their local paper right away.
Yes, and be like, yeah, what is that website company?
That's Electric Pulp.
Electric Pulp.
Yeah. Yeah. Love it.
That's gold, baby. Yeah.
Really
We're
cool.
going to be well listened to.
The name kind of sold us, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, totally. That's a very hip name for mm-hmm. a South Dakota company.
Right.
We don't usually get into, you know, personal things, you know, with our guests. But, I mean, I have to ask Prime Meats and all that. I mean, that's a really cool place to work. You know, how's it going there? I mean, they're going through some changes, right? Expansion.
Yeah. Prime Meats is great. Like, I've been with those guys for going on 6 years.
Wow.
I've known Frank Falcinelli for... over 10 years and I mean it's awesome, and they're just a great bunch of guys to be with. And
what's their management style, like loosey-goosey or like controlling, or like how are they as a man, because I really know nothing.
Do they whack you on the back of the head?
No, not at all. They definitely how do I say this, they're definitely casual, their management style. but they
eye on the prize.
They expect you to get the job.
They're very professional, and they know what's going on, and they're
there. And Laura, are you working there also?
I am not. I'm actually currently the pastry chef at Mirandi Restaurant.
Oh. Ooh, Mirandi.
Ooh.
Keith McNally's place.
But neither of you have quit your day jobs.
No. This is primarily a side gig for the time being.
And how many hours a week does it require of your time? Is it like becoming more and more of a big job, or is it now that you've got it launched, it's kind of minding itself?
Well, the work was really getting it launched, mm-hmm. and we were working on it for probably, I don't know, over a year and a half. There's a lot of working parts, a lot of things that need to be tweaked here and there. But now that it's up, it still has its challenges, and it's promoting it and getting it out there and talking about it and sharing.
Well, you know, my mom is listening for sure. If she needs a job in the industry, she's gonna. Well, working for Mirandi, talking about management stock, Keith McNally. I heard he would go every once in a while up to like his hot hostesses at Balthazar and be like, "Do you work for me?" And they'd be like, "Yes, Mr. McNally." And he's like, "So why aren't you working?"
Ooh.
Which I thought was like very charming.
I guess Laura hasn't had that experience yet.
No, I have not.
So you do Italian desserts? Or?
I do. I just started in December, and having come from craft, and I spent a lot of time doing American desserts and very comfortable with that. So I'm learning Italian desserts right now.
How fun.
So you were with Kraft during what era? During the Damon Wise era?
Yes, Wise, Karen Damasco for 3 years. So.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
It was a great kitchen. I learned so much.
She's a very nice person before? To work with, Karen Damasco. I've heard that from many people. Yeah.
She's amazing.
Heard the same about me, Katie?
No, I haven't.
What did you study at FCI before?
I did. I went to the French Culinary Institute. Graduated.
So it actually does work.
I'm pre-Hervé, actually. I graduated 2004. It does actually work.
I wanted to ask Hervé, and we didn't get a chance. I'm going to make him come back, or somebody, or maybe Nils. But like, you know, going through that expensive education, mm-hmm. like, do you come out with like just a boatload of student loans and a minimum wage
job? Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, that'd be a really interesting question to see how he answers that one. Like, yes, it's a farce.
Translator
Patrick rolls his eyes. That is a real problem.
Well, that's going to be one of those questions that gets a 1 second answer, and then we're like, next question.
Yeah, like when I asked Brad Farmer if he made sorbets in between. In between
is your food good,
courses.
Brad?
Yeah, right.
Anyway, guys, so 86list.com.
That's right. That's
for anybody who's in the restaurant industry and wants to either staff or find a job. That's where to go.
86list.com. You can do a search on our website for 86list, which is the number 86list.com, and hook up with a very dynamic connecting force within
fantastic.
The food world.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot for coming in, you guys.
Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it. It's the main course on Heritage Radio Network, sponsored today by S. Wallace Edwards & Son in Surrey, Virginia. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my partner in crime, Patrick Martins, and we welcome to the studio our long-lost friend and colleague, the
Mike,
the amazing, the never-to-be-forgotten Mike Edison.
Yay! All right. Yay. Thank you.
Mike has just finished writing a book, and that's why we haven't seen you in so long, because you've been hard at work banging the keyboard.
Yeah, doing my homework on Sunday afternoons instead of getting stoned with you kids.
So what have you been doing?
Being
Tell
responsible,
us about
Patrick.
This book.
Yeah. Well, he's being an author.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got
homework.
Doesn't drugs help at all with writing? I know it helps with like music writing.
You've got a contract and everything, right?
Yeah, yeah. The book's gonna be out. The book's called Dirty, Dirty, Dirty. It's gonna be out in October on a Soft Skull Press.
Oh, I love that press.
I'm very, very, very happy to be with an awesome indie press.
Yeah, they're wonderful. They're
left
wonderful
my big time corporate
it.
New York publisher for a very cool indie press out of Berkeley, California.
So dirty, 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 dirty. I imagine it's dirty, about dirty. Pollution and carbon dioxide.
It's about
ozone.
Smut,
the
Patrick.
Environment.
It's about filth, a different kind of filth.
Oh.
It's about, this book is...
Heading back to your roots there, right?
Cancel the live stream, Jack.
You know, Katie, they say write about what you know. This book is a pop culture history of men's magazines, starting in the 50s with Hugh Hefner and then winding its way across Screw
Magazine.
But you
don't love Hugh Hefner.
I'm sorry?
Do you love Hugh Hefner?
No, I don't love Hugh Hefner.
What's that?
And the more I wrote about him, the less I was charmed.
You were not charmed by Hugh with his...
Charmed by a 90-year-old guy padding around in his pajamas, pretending, you know, to have like a 12-year-old girlfriend? It's kind of gross, don't you think?
Well, now, yeah. But I mean, in his heyday, come on. He was
his
hot.
He was a real entrepreneur.
Was when? John F. Kennedy was still alive.
50 years ago. That guy's 90 years old.
Playboy ruled the 60s. Playboy was such a good magazine in the 60s.
Yeah.
And they had big things. I mean, didn't Jimmy Carter do a very famous interview
with Playboy? Yes, they asked him about killing the rabbit in the rowboat, remember?
No, they asked
killing the rabbit in the rowboat?
He was in the rowboat, and the lethal rabbit tried to attack him, and he killed it with an oar.
That's
Don't
where
you
he
remember
said...
That? And that's where he said, I have sinned in my mind.
I have committed adultery in my mind.
Yeah.
But that was probably the last important interview they truly did. Hey, Playboy's a great magazine, and Hefner did some great things. He was
he really
pioneer.
Did.
Everything that came after him, really, you know, he really had, you know, godfathered. He opened up the newsstands for everybody. He legitimized nudity in a magazine.
Who predated him? Who were his precursors?
Well, Esquire is where he sort of launched from. And there were lots of men's magazines at the time. There were lots of men's magazines in the 1940s during the Second World War. There were pinup magazines, you know, the Vargas Girls and the girls in Esquire. And George Petty was another famous pinup artist. There were a lot of things what were called Patriotica.
Oh, I love
a lot of red,
George
white, and
Petty.
Blue and can
George
can
Petty
girls.
Is the one with the celery in every picture, right? You don't know that? Oh, my sister sent me a whole website about
His
him.
His intern
and he these-
didn't get him any information on that.
Yeah.
But Hefner sort of like, you know, took the best elements of Esquire and, you know, he just sort of, you know, scammed some stuff from the downmarket girly magazines and slapped it together. And, you know, he made it smart. He made girly magazines smart.
What were downmarket girly magazines then? Because they weren't showing nude women.
Oh, lots of men's adventure magazines, Stag.
They were just showing girls in their bathing suits then.
Well, there was always a sort of off the newsstand market for girly magazines and, you know, men's magazines. But on the newsstands, aside from, you know, the pinups in Esquire, which were risque, but not nude.
But not nude.
And, of course, the girls in Playboy at first weren't really nude. They were topless. They were topless. And even then, you weren't always getting, you know...
The full frontal.
You know, for a magazine that was famous for putting naked women in it, you'd just be surprised at how few naked women actually were in the damn thing.
They were the first naked women I'd ever seen besides my mother when I was growing up.
But that's tragic, I think.
I mean,
it'd be more tragic if I had said that, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
National Geographic.
National Geographic was the go-to place. And the truth is, if it weren't for Hefner, we'd all be reading National Geographic.
Yeah.
But, you know, he hasn't really changed since, you know, 19... He still thinks it's 1953 in his head.
So I'm sorry.
Well, so who,
it's
who
sad,
has
don't
taken
you think?
That?
Huh? I mean, it's sad. I mean, this old man and his dotage sort of stumbling around.
Well, he has a shtick, and he's not... He hasn't updated it in a while.
And there's his kayfabe. That's the kayfabe.
That's too bad. But
tell us. So we interrupted
cool.
you. You were saying from Hugh Hefner to what is the trajectory?
Well, really, Al Goldstein and Screw was really the next guy to make a huge mark on the landscape. That was 1968. Penthouse had come out in England before that. Penthouse was in England a few years before that. And that was a complete Playboy knockoff, straight up. Although it became a little bit more risque, a little bit more sexier.
Definitely, because they had definitely sexy stories in the beginning.
Penthouse was an amazing magazine in the 70s. Absolutely great. A lot hotter than Playboy was.
Oh, yeah.
Guccione, you know, had a whole different, much more sexually explicit, but with a whole different idea, a whole different point
Why
of view.
Why do I know so much?
Well, the point of this book is that it's part of American history. And
totally.
My book isn't so much a history of men's magazines as it is a pop culture history, sort of using the side of the newsstand as some sort of barometer. Because, as I always say, as the world turns, so goes its pornography. And you can always tell from decade to decade between men's magazines and professional wrestling. There you go. You can know all you need to know.
Now, does pornography exist in even the most suppressed cultures like the Middle East or Russia during the communist
era? There is always smut. People
want
smut.
How does it manifest itself?
Get between people and their pornography. Well, I mean, just look at, you know, America, Patrick. I mean, people have been trying to put a stop to this since the get-go. There have always been some prudes, some moral police since the early days. There were in ancient Rome. I mean, there were in ancient Greece.
I would like you to define pornography.
And it has failed like every other attempt at American prohibition. You know, every time they try to prohibit anything, you know, drugs, booze, you know, the free press, it fails wildly. You know, they tried to put stickers on records to, you know, let people know that there were, you know, bad words.
That was
bad
Tipper time. Gore.
Yeah, and you saw what happens after that. We had gangster rap and the most filthiest heavy metal records of all time. Well, no self-respecting rock and roller would put out a record without that label now. It always fails. You cannot get...
Do you think that's unique to America?
No.
Yeah,
people like sex. Americans tend to be a bit more repressed than other cultures.
Well, I know that's... I mean, many people say that because of our Puritan history, that we still have a strong Puritan streak, and I suppose that's true. But I guess what I really want to know from you, Mike, since you're such an expert, is can you define pornography for us? What does that mean?
I know
exactly?
it when I see it. I know it when I see it, and I think you do, too.
People can talk about pornography and say, there's a certain, I mean, for instance, what made me ask that question is when you were talking about, like, even in the Middle East, when Patrick said, do they have pornography in the Middle East? And I thought to myself, in a certain sense, terrorist acts are their form of pornography because they're thinking about, like, what they're going to get at the end. And it's always, the cliche is that it's a sexual
death
reward.
Death is sex, I mean, for them in a way, because it's a better place.
Yeah, that there's a sexual reward.
I don't think they really
Technically.
You don't think so? I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that.
I think they just are, well, anyway.
We talk about things like food porn. You know,
meat porn for Patrick's website.
Sure, and really what pornography is something that's solely meant to spark someone's prurient interest, their desire, and has no other real value to it. It's a tricky definition. I mean, really, purely pornography is about sex. It has to do with sparking someone's prurient sexual desire. What that means, it's a real tricky slope, and obviously that line has moved and has eroded so far. I was driving in a cab, and I'm watching, you know, the screen in the back of the cab, this advertisement for Guess Jeans, and it is steamy. I mean, this is like this Guess Jeans ad in the back of the cab, and it's like, holy cow. I mean, this could have been, you know, a Penthouse-produced video circa 1989. It was hot.
Or that Guess ad on Houston Street. It was steamy. It was always a steamy
one. What, with the two
one.
Kids? The
no,
little
no,
teenage
it changes
boy
all the
and girl?
Time.
This was stroke fodder. No. I mean, this was real stroke fodder.
I haven't heard that one before.
Yeah, this is in the back of the cab, and it was like, holy cow. And I'll tell you what, though, Katie, this is the kind of thing that I don't like because I was a captive audience being hit with very highly sexually charged images, and that I've always been against. I mean, I believe in the concept of a willing public.
Right.
You know, and I thought, you know, in a way, this has actually crossed the line. Most people are never going to say Mike Edison's a prude, but I thought this was a little steamy. This was so suggestive, so clearly prurient. You know, it was Madison Avenue fashion ad.
Designed to, yes.
Is that what you're...
Exactly, are you kidding? If I was 13, I would have stopped the cab.
Yeah. You would have flooded it?
Yeah. Ooh, yeah.
As a parent, you think about, like, what is my kid, you know, I mean, and people wonder why their children are so highly sexualized.
Well, tell us about the book. Is this issues the book covers?
Absolutely. You know, we talk about, like I said, it's called Dirty, Dirty, Dirty. And the subtitle is Of Playboys, Pigs, and Penthouse Paupers, An American Tale of Sex and Wonder. And it really covers the great 50-year span when girly magazines on the newsstands were exciting before it just sort of became tawdry sex and, you know, the internet took over and we don't have that sense of wonder, of opening up a magazine and looking forward to seeing Miss July or wondering what outrage Larry Flint's going to create this month or what, you know, outrage Screw Magazine is going to happen. These men are larger than life magazine publishers in a field where you don't really get rock stars. Mm-hmm. You know, Hefner, Bob Guccione, Larry Flint, these guys.
Yeah. Charlie Sheen.
Were very famous.
He hasn't published his magazine yet.
Charlie Sheen is coming out with, he's going around. I see him on radio. I mean, I hear him on radio inviting people to a party
in
New Jersey.
Sheen preferred seems to be in the basement with no takers right now.
No, I think he's fun. I would think you would admire him. There's a certain kayfabe to him, no?
I don't think so. There's a certain like total manic. I mean, yeah, I just see nothing but mental anymore. Illness.
Well,
what about kayfabe with who is River Phoenix? No, Joaquin Phoenix. Joaquin That's kayfabe.
Well, yeah, but that was a put on. That was a hoax, right?
Oh, when
that,
he retired from acting and became a bum.
And
I mean, you gotta maintain that cave. I mean, I don't know about Sheen. He's just clearly out of his mind.
I think
but there's something to admire
bit.
About a guy who says, look, I love whores, I love crack. And so what?
I mean,
his right to smoke crack and screw whores seems to end at the wall, you know, where it hits my nose, I guess. I mean, why not? It doesn't make him a bad guy.
I don't care if he does it or not. I don't want to know about it.
No, so, you know, I mean, no,
that's the thing. And then, you know, and so then it's hard to know.
It doesn't make him a bad guy, though.
No, I just think he's crazy.
Winning.
He's kind of boring.
He's just winning.
He got boring very fast.
Yeah, right.
Well,
yeah.
As a gimmick, it's not very nuanced.
He's playing Radio City Music Hall to sold out
That's
audiences.
Not going to happen. It's not sold out. He probably sold about 12 tickets, and StubHub's holding the rest, and they're going to lose on that. That's going to be team losing.
You think, really?
I was just reading the reviews of his gig in Detroit.
What does he do?
In my favorite right-wing hate sheet, the New York Post, which I can't live without, of course.
What does he do on
that? It still goes with your persona.
Apparently, he babbles a little bit about cocaine and tiger's blood, and then people boo him and he leaves.
Yeah, it's bombing.
Oh, man.
No script.
The only loser is the concept of winning.
Forget about Charlie Sheen. Let's talk more about, I think the idea of a history of how sexuality has come to the point that it is in popular culture now is a pretty interesting concept.
Yeah, well, you know, we went to the point where people were scared to death of, you know, a semi-naked woman in a centerfold. People were banning poetry because it was risque.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, Seinfeld is making whole shows about oral sex and contraception.
Yeah.
I mean, right? You know, the whole show is dedicated to masturbation.
Or it's MASH, like, even if you go back as far as MASH. Or Laughing, even.
But those were adult. They were risque. They were bawdy. They were,
MASH, I mean,
there was
a
wink
body.
And, there was a wink and a nod there. There's no winking and nodding with Seinfeld. It's out there. This is a show about masturbating, and it's on 10 times a day. And I mean, therein lies, you know, the unwilling audience. I don't know the kids need to see that. I mean, I'm certainly unapologetic about enjoying pornography, creating pornography, thinking that it's, you know, a positive thing. But at that same time, I don't think it's for everybody, and I think people should have a choice to not see it.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Interesting. The last time I saw you, Mike, was when we were at that, you had organized an event around censorship. So this is an interesting take on
that. Who are you trying to censor?
I'm putting my foot down. Heritage Radio. In fact, I owe you a book. I have your book today.
Yeah, you
Katie,
better.
Yeah,
with a heartfelt attribution.
Wait, I didn't get one.
There was this. You've gotten one.
Duh, you didn't go to the event.
That was last year's banned book party.
Yeah.
And there'll be another one this year in September, I guess.
I thought it was great, and I think it's important to keep that up in people's consciousness.
Can you
really
tell us the chapters?
From that event.
I just want to say that the banned book party, you know, free speech trials, the fight for free speech seems so passe, it's almost quaint now. But really, if we're not vigilant, a lot of the things that we've won, and people like Larry Flint and Al Goldstein, and the rights won, you know, by books like Howl and Naked Lunch, and people like Ralph Ginsberg and Lenny Bruce, it was very important. I mean, every rapper in the world should be thanking Lenny Bruce for being able to get up there, because there was a time when they were saying it would get you tossed in the jug.
Yeah. I would love to do a whole hour and a half on Lenny Bruce and
let's
have a
do
few
it.
Guests come on and talk about
special.
That guy.
Let's do it.
Guys,
Lenny Bruce
special.
Is really the unsung hero of my book. I talk about the men's magazines, but Lenny Bruce is really the connecting DNA.
Do you mention him in your book?
He's one of the heroes. Mm-hmm. He'd worked for Hugh Hefner. He'd actually worked for Mad Magazine, which is very important to the whole thing, too.
Do you write about Mad Magazine?
Of course,
yeah?
Because it's all connected.
Excellent.
From Mad Magazine to Hustler is a straight line. It hasn't really been mapped out that way before, I don't think, so hopefully...
Before, because we're going to have to wrap up in a few minutes, but what about the last... we actually end at 1:30 now. We try to
1:33. I got Jack to stay 3 extra minutes, but it won't be tagged.
No, but Mike, what... okay, so after Hustler... Who has launched a men's magazine?
Well,
Nerve.
After that, well, it will change.
What else? What's happened?
I mean, obviously, things moved to the internet, obviously, at some point. But the 70s were a golden time for men's magazines. I mean, there were dozens of them. Swank and Velvet and High Society and Cherry and on and on and on. I mean, Hustler was publishing dozens of them. I think at some point, the men's magazines sort of ate themselves. There were just so many of them.
Yeah.
And they're cannibalizing their own product.
Do you have a collection?
And it was so easy. to get them, that they were no longer, you know, contraband at some point. They no longer had any value because right. they were so easy to get. There was no barrier to market. You know, when yeah. Larry Flynt was doing this thing, you know, he almost went to jail for it. And he did do time for various things. I mean, Penthouse was on the edge of what was considered obscene. And obscenity is not legal. Obscenity is illegal. Pornography, it's been said, is the legal version of obscenity, which is a little glib for me, but it happens to be true. Something is not obscene just because it shows explicit sexual material. It has to have some redeeming value. It has to do with community standards as the laws have shifted. So it's very hard to prove obscenity now. But in 1974, when Larry Flynt came out of the gate, he had, you know, a bunch of douchebag federal prosecutors and uptight moralists. Charles yeah. Keating, remember sure. him?
Yeah.
He was responsible for savings and loaning.
Keating 5. Yeah,
yeah. Keating 5. And before that, he had his group Citizens for Decency. I mean, he was a big anti pornography crusader.
Mike, were
yes,
there any famous women in that time? Like
founders
of the industry who were women?
Not,
either as models or in the executive office?
Well, the most important
thing.
I'd be
more interested in the executive office. Weren't any women running men's magazines?
Well, Kathy Keaton, Bob Guccione's paramour and later wife, was always very important in running that operation. Interesting about Hugh Hefner, you know, of all the women he's dated, who's he dated? Playmates. You've never seen him date a woman who had anything going on. You know, besides really working for Playboy. And to me, that's really creepy. This is a guy who talks a good game about liberating women, but in no way has ever empowered them.
Yeah, right.
Well,
in no way.
His daughter took over the
and she tanked.
Magazine.
She tanked the business. He hired his daughter, and yeah. she tanked the business. It was worth about $1 billion when she came in. 9 years later, it was worth about 20% of that.
Wow.
And she walked away with a $2 million severance package.
$2 million isn't very much. In
when
thing.
You lose 80% of a company's value,
look at some of the know, guys who walked away from the federal from
I know.
The banks.
I know, but this is Playboy,
just
not
recently.
Enron. You know, and, yeah. and but the truth is, no, he doesn't empower women. But the
that
fact
is the truth.
The real truth, though, the secret, and it's not, it shouldn't be a secret, is that women make it all possible. Men's magazines are not possible without the women who are in them.
Well,
pornography
that's why it's
is powered by women.
You can't name any of them, though. The early first models, though. I mean,
You mean like
Betty Page?
Betty Page, or I mean, the first the pinup girls. I mean, you know, there are tons
was
of
Betty
them.
Boop modeled after a hot
she
I mean,
was.
Woman?
And her skirts went up and up and up.
You could see, yeah.
Oh, definitely. Very big. And then in the 60s,
is that Disney?
Suddenly her skirt went down. No, it was those guys. It was Fleischer's.
Max
the Fleischer's that came up with Betty Boop, I think.
They also
and then it was adopted by other companies. But I think she remained in the Fleischer
so
family.
What do you think, Patrick? Can a cartoon be as sexy as the real thing?
Well, I saw one girl who, you know, might have been a stroker was Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, I was just
Jessica
say,
Rabbit.
Jessica Rabbit, yeah.
Love Jessica Rabbit.
Yeah.
Not the
hot.
Rabbit. That sounded weird.
I don't know. This is like new lingo for me. A stroker? Mike, did you just like coin something? Or Patrick, have you always said that?
No, that's a first for me.
Okay, so we've just coined a new
The stroke
you know,
is in the young man's vernacular. As in
is it?
Stroke worthy, stroke mag.
These tags today,
Jack?
Guys, these tags are going to get us some hits.
Yes.
That's all I'm saying.
Jack
I've been told that sex sells.
Jack, you're young. Tell me, is it part of your parlance?
I have no comment right. on
any of this. So before we get 86 here,
yes.
WrestleMania tonight.
Oh, WrestleMania!
WrestleMania is tonight. Oh, today is a red letter day.
Has he lost yet?
The Undertaker
has not lost.
Is 18-0. Tonight's Undertaker night. I don't have the greatest expectations for tonight's event, but the Undertaker versus Triple H certainly is the main event. To see if the Undertaker keeps his streak and why it's difficult when it's difficult to bet on something whose outcome is predetermined
because he's the Walking Dead.
That seems a little
no, but you should do it anyway.
Less
for the cave
less than righteous. But my money is on the Undertaker and for Triple H to do the right thing and let the Undertaker go out with a streak intact.
Now, how many people know the plan before the plan? Obviously, with the Undertaker, that's different.
This is top secret. This is very, very top secret.
Yeah, yeah. It stays within the actor and the director.
This is a high state secret. More,
okay.
You know, more people know about the invasion of Libya than know about this.
Interesting.
No doubt about that.
No question. This is top secret.
Will he ever lose? Now, even Andre the Giant lost to then keep the tradition of wrestling alive. Is the whole deal with The Undertaker that he will never lose?
Well, he's lost. He's just never lost at WrestleMania.
Oh.
He's the only one who's never lost at the, you know, in the
so that's
event.
What time tonight can people catch that?
Well, it's 7:00. It's I don't even know what they're getting for it this year. $50. I think it was $60 last year.
Oh my God, really?
Junkyard Dog and Jimmy Fly Snuka getting like a lifetime achievement award between bouts?
I think they're both in the Hall of Fame already, the so-called Wrestling Hall of Fame.
Are there retired outfits like hanging in a wall?
There should be.
There should be, right?
There should be, right. I mean, I don't think there actually is. There is like a virtual Wrestling Hall of Fame, but I think there should be.
A lot of times it would just be like a,
you know, I'd go there.
Bikini.
Oh, definitely.
You know, like
especially if they showed everybody in their costumes.
You see, like,
the
sharpened piece of wood that Abdullah the Butcher would use carve up the Sheik.
Yeah, I
can see that.
Is this pay per view?
Yeah, pay per view.
Pay per view. Okay, well, you guys, we have to wrap it up here. So, Mike Edison, thanks so much for coming by and talking about your book, Dirty, Dirty, Dirty.
Good to
see
you guys.
This is the advance preview. Yeah.
Next week, we have Carmen from Quagliata,
the chef
of Union Square. We have the owner of Egg. Which is a real honor.
Another great restaurant.
And then, I don't know. And then
the
maybe
Brooklyn Slate.
Oh, Brooklyn Slate. Talking about Slate.
Maybe the owner of Egg can actually get me a reservation.
Yes.
Whoa,
I think, Jack, if you tag
happen.
Him right.
That could be in the cards for you,
Greg,
Jackie.
I've been trying for 3 years to get into that place.
Mr.
This is it.
We'll definitely
That's
do
ridiculous.
It.
That's
so.
Ridiculous. All right. Well,
this show's been 86.
Jack, thanks a lot.
And
for
Jack,
engineering.
Will you
to...
read us about the film festival and Whole Foods?
Yes, we will.
Thanks.
Next week. See you next week.
Whole Foods Market celebrates Earth Month with Do Something Real Film Festival, a collection of six provocative, character-driven films focused on food, environmental issues, and everyday people with a greater vision. Come see one of the six features at City Cinema's Village East from Saturday, April 16th through Thursday, April 21st, every night at 6 p.m. Learn more about the films and special events at www.dosomethingreal.com. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. The Snacky Tunes compilation has arrived and is available for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com. This compilation features live performances from some of the hottest acts around today, including Midnight Magic, Surfer Blood, Oberhofer, and more. Again, you can download this compilation for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com, and make sure to listen to Snacky Tunes every Monday at 2 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network.